You know, I've been so fascinated with all of this that I haven't done what's fair, and somebody gives us something like we're getting tonight. He's written some books. He sure does deserve an opportunity to plug the heck out of them. Professor, your books, and they're definitely going to want your books, so which ones would you recommend?
Well, the book that is a primer on the unified field theory and all this excitement that is generated is Hyperspace. It was a bestseller, and I highly recommend that. There's another book called Beyond Einstein, which also talks about particle physics and the quantum theory and also string theory.
Mm-hmm.
Then for those people interested in the future, there's a book I wrote called Visions.
Assuming we have one.
Right. And on my website, you see descriptions of all these books, mkaku.org, mkaku.org.
All right.
And we have over 30 million hits on that website.
I bet you do.
And, thanks to you, of course. And I have two books coming out next year. In April, I have a modern biography of Albert Einstein in time for the centennial. The centennial of relativity is 2005. 100 years of E equals MC squared.
You've really been busy.
That's right. So in April, a modern biography of Einstein called Einstein's Cosmos, totally reevaluating the legacy of the man. And, of course, the 2005 is the 100th year anniversary.
Can you lay a couple of highlights of that on us? I mean, a modern biography of Einstein, what is it we know today? What outstanding facts about Einstein do we know today that rewrite what we thought we knew?
Well, if you read all the biographies of the man, all of them say that after 1925, he was over the hill, no more ideas, and that he spent all his time working for peace. But scientifically, he was washed up by 1925.
Not so, huh?
Not so. If you take a look at modern history today with satellites, we now have satellites that can prove all the conjectures that Einstein made in the 1930s and 40s that could not be verified without satellites. Gravity wave detectors, for example, from colliding black holes. Black holes themselves have now been detected with the Hubble Space Telescope and X-ray telescope. Not to mention Einstein rings, that is, the distortion of distant starlight, so that light from a distant galaxy looks like a ring rather than like a dot. Not to mention the fact that Nobel Prizes have been given for scientists who've investigated crumbs off Einstein's table, like Bose-Einstein condensates, won several Nobel Prizes for individuals, all of which was predicted by Albert Einstein. And of course, he spent the later decades of his life searching for the unified field theory. And that, of course, is now the dominant theme within my field, theoretical physics. It's a gold rush. If you're young and ambitious, you want to crack the unified field theory. There's a bunch of Nobel Prizes waiting for young people who can crack the biggest problem of all time.
I'm curious about something with regard to Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you suppose, Professor, there was a moment when Einstein said to himself, before he let anybody know about anything, he's, you know, that look, I understand in my own mind that what I am about to do is the equivalent of handing a four-year-old child a cherry bomb and a lit match.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Do you suppose and with his intellect, he still handed us the cherry bomb and the match? I mean, he really did, and there had to be that moment for him.
Well, it happened in stages. First of all, he knew it was a cherry bomb, but he did not have the match. And originally, he thought the match was impossible. And in the 1920s, journalists would always ask him about E equals MC squared and whether a bomb could be made.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as you point out, yeah, it is a cherry bomb. It's there, but there's no match, you see. And what shocked him was that the match was finally created in the late 30s with the chain reaction. Einstein never thought that there could be a chain reaction that could then set off. He made one reference to a chain reaction, by the way.
So then he didn't really fully understand the implications of his early work at that moment.
Well, he knew that a bomb could be made if you could have this match, and he toyed with the idea of a chain reaction. There's one quote where he actually says that perhaps there's some way to magnify the minute energy contained within a nucleus, but he didn't know the steps by which to do this. And that, of course, was done by Otto Hahn, Liz Meitler in the late 1930s, giving us the possibility of critical mass. So with Einstein, he knew that there was potential to release enormous amounts of energy. He suspected that the stars got their energy this way. So it was possible to unleash this energy. Just look at the sun, right? Just look at the galaxy.
Sure.
So he knew that nature unleashes this technology. He didn't think that on Earth you could unleash the power of the sun. Now we know, of course, that an atomic bomb is nothing but a piece of the sun placed on the Earth. But so Einstein suspected that this was a secret of the stars. But he had no way of lighting the match.
Yeah.
Now we know how to light the match.
Right.
And that's caused all this problem.
So he couldn't see that far ahead, simply put. All right. Michael from Kansas City has a really good question. Since we've been on this bomb topic, this is a really good one. Whatever happened to the neutron bomb? Now, the neutron bomb would have changed everything, or shouldn't it have? Or do we have neutron bombs? Do we still have them? They killed without blowing stuff up, right?
People call them the landlord's bomb because it's a great way clever way to evict the tenants without damaging your building.
How effective would that bomb, or is that bomb? I mean, could you destroy an entire, just kill everything in a city without touching, blowing anything up?
Okay, let's talk about bombs through generations. The first generation atomic bombs were huge, gigantic devices that were so big they could barely fit in the bomb bay of a B-52 bomber. Those are first-generation bombs.
Yes.
Second-generation bombs are small MIRVs. You could put 10 of them in the nose cone of an MX missile.
Right.
These are called second-generation bombs. Small bombs. They're about 3 feet tall, 2.5 feet tall. Huh. Third-generation bombs are designer bombs. And they are now slowly being devised and talked about. In fact, the Bush administration wants to allocate money now for the third generation. Third-generation bombs are designer bombs. They are specifically designed for various purposes, to be used in the desert, to be used underground, to be used in outer space, to be used in the jungle. Different designs of bombs for different purposes. These are called third-generation.
Uh-huh.
The neutron bomb is a two-and-a-half-generation bomb. It's between the second and third generation. It's often called a two-and-a-half-generation bomb.
All right.
And as I mentioned, in 1991, get a copy of Newsweek magazine in January or February of that year, just before the outbreak of hostilities. Newsweek magazine interviewed several senior Pentagon officials, and they laid out the option. The neutron bomb was an option. First, they would hit Baghdad with the electromagnetic pulse. A bomb would be detonated over Baghdad. The pulse, the shockwave from the bomb would wipe out all the electronics, wiping out their surface-to-air missile defense system.
You're not talking about, or are you talking about, actually, a very large bomb detonated very high, or...
That's right. A conventional hydrogen bomb detonated over Baghdad, which would cause a shockwave.
How far over Baghdad?
Oh, you would have to do it several miles above the city, or else it would create, you know, heat and devastation. But the shockwave... the United States did this back in the 1960s. It sent a Thor missile up into space and detonated a hydrogen bomb in space. And much to our shock, it created a shockwave which wiped out communications to some degree between San Francisco and Tokyo. It set off burglar alarms all over Hawaii. And then we realized a new phenomenon had been discovered, the electromagnetic pulse. We had never seen that before. And so the military had suddenly realized that in case of a real war, if they had detonated that bomb, we would have wiped out our own satellites.
Yes.
We would have blinded ourselves with the electromagnetic pulse. So anyway, the Newsweek magazine article lays out that first you'd hit Baghdad with a electromagnetic pulse weapon.
Right.
Then you would hit conventional troop emplacements with the neutron bomb. The neutron bomb would then be used against conventional troop emplacements.
I'm trying to get a sense of the scope of a neutron bomb. How wide an area could it virtually sterilize?
It's a small atomic bomb, about a kiloton's worth, while the Hiroshima bomb was maybe 10 times that, 10,
yes.
15 times bigger than that. So it's a sub-Hiroshima type bomb that does emit heat, does emit blast, but it's minimal compared to what a Hiroshima bomb emits.
How big a blast?
Oh, it'd be quite devastating. If you hit it in a modern city, you'd do a considerable damage to the downtown area. Not much more, but you'd knock out a large portion of the downtown area.
And then beyond that, the radiation effects?
Much less, because most of the radiation is in neutrons. So this would be used against troop emplacements. Huh. If you have a concentrated number of troops, you'd hit them with a neutron bomb, and that's a kiloton of power. Realize that in the Iraqi war that many people saw on their TV screens,
yes,
we were talking about a 1,000-pound bomb or 2,000-pound bomb, okay? And now we're talking about kilotons of TNT.
Actually, they were
several orders of magnitude.
They were talking about tens of thousands of pounds, I believe, are equivalent to, in TNT, really a crazy giant figure. The Moab, mother of all bombs or something. It was,
yeah, the mother of all bombs is,
impressive.
Again, in the ton range.
Right.
However, a nuclear weapon would be in the kiloton, 1,000-ton range. We're,
yes,
talking about 1,000 times more than the mother of all bombs. So the neutron bomb packs a much bigger wallop than the mother of all bombs.
Somehow I always had it in my head that the neutron bomb virtually didn't even go boom. It just did this incredible radiation thing.
It's basically a stripped-down hydrogen bomb. A hydrogen bomb has three layers. A fission layer in the center, and then we're talking about an extra uranium, lithium deuteride surrounding that. And then surrounding that is another layer of uranium.
Well, then this breaks a giant myth, because the myth always was the neutron bomb was a totally clean thing to do and all.
No, it's quite messy.
Quite messy.
It has blast, has heat, has everything. It has all the bad stuff of a regular bomb, except a lot of the radiation is in neutron form. So instead of a three-layer bomb, it's a two-layer bomb. You strip off the last uranium layer of a hydrogen bomb, and you get a neutron bomb, basically.
Wonderful.
So a neutron bomb is a stripped-down hydrogen bomb. So it does create blast. It does create lots of problems. And the Europeans hated it because it was to be used on their cities. It was to be used on troop emplacement in your cities. And so the Europeans realized there'd be nothing left of Europe if the neutron bomb was set off. So the neutron bomb still exists, and hopefully it'll never be used in warfare. But it is a 2.5-generation bomb, because the third-generation bombs are earth penetrators, and they're designed to detonate underground. And, like I said, the Bush administration has already placed it in the budget.
That is to kill underground bunkers, that kind of thing.
Yeah, to collapse, basically to bury people that are underground in bunkers.
Yes.
The North Koreans, of course, are deathly afraid of that, because most of their leadership is placed underground.
That's right.
And so I think that's probably one reason why the Bush administration
is developing, yeah,
For these things specifically to threaten the leadership of North Korea, which is basically underground. So these are third-generation bombs, designer bombs, to be used in outer space as Star Wars, to be used on the ground as neutron bombs, and to be used underground as nuclear earth penetrators and bunker busters.
There are those, Professor, who say that President Reagan's threat of Star Wars brought down communism, or that's unfair, I guess, was at least a fairly large factor in the final collapse. Do you buy into that?
Well, Ronald Reagan was once interviewed by a journalist who asked him a question. Spending Russia into a depression, that's always been the right wing strategy. Spending Russia into a depression. We build a bomb, they build a bomb.
Yes.
Well, the journalist asked, won't this backfire on the United States? Won't we be plunged into depression? And, the president thought for a while, and then he said, maybe, but they'll bust first.
Wow.
Well, they bust first, and we could very well bust second. So it was very clear, I think, from Reagan's own quote, that he knew it was a game of chicken, mm-hmm, that they were going to be spending themselves into a depression, we're spending ourselves into a depression, and who wins is the one who busts second. So Russia bust first. Their commissars mistakenly thought that security meant building more bombs, which meant less potatoes on people's dinner plate.
Well, here's what I always wondered about, Professor. Russia really, because it was kind of a failed economic plan, they could only continue to thrive by continuing to eat up territory, take more territory. territory. If you've got a system that's not producing a profit, you got to keep. That's the only way you can do it, is take more territory. And it got to a point, I guess, where they couldn't do that without a suicidal act. But still, there must have been that moment of horrid consideration on the part of the communists when they realized their system couldn't expand at all because of the threat that they faced of extinction. So they couldn't do that. But then again, they had all these weapons. And if ever there was going to be a time to use them, a dark, psychologically disturbed moment when they would make the decision to use them, that would have come somewhere in there just before they went belly up economically and said, we quit.
Well, I think that the problem is the opposite. The problem with the Soviet Union was stagnation. Capitalism is quite vibrant. In fact, so vibrant that, it does cause inequities.
Yes.
But the Soviet system creates the opposite, stability. Stability is a point of stagnation.
Yes.
So it's not the expansion, it's the stagnation that was always the worry. And in order to get out of that stagnation, you had to have technology, new ideas, and, entrepreneurial spirit, as Ronald Reagan would say.
Yes.
And they lacked that. In fact, it got worse because they built so many bombs to catch up to the United States. You know, their economy was about a third of the U.S. economy, and they were trying to match. They were trying to match our weapons.
Sure.
And that was the right-wing strategy, to lure the Russians to take potato off the dinner tables and to build weapons like the SS-18, the SS-20. To match the MX.
Well, that's why I kind of asked you, do you think Star Wars was the final trumping hand and the straw that broke the commies' back?
No, I don't think so. I think,
or at least part of it.
Well, I think what did them in was their own short-sightedness into thinking that security meant building more bombs. You know, the United States always led in building bombs. Every bomb was initiated first by the United States, first, second, third generation, all three generations.
Sure.
First initiated by the United States.
Yes.
The Russians should have said, okay, we stop. We have enough bombs to kill everybody, so we should stop and then put more potato on people's dinner table. But they didn't. They just kept building SS-18s, SS-20s to match the MX and to match the Minuteman III, and it destabilized their system. So I think they'd done themselves in. It was self-inflicted to a certain degree.
Still, coming at the appropriate moment, Star Wars must have caused a lot of generals in Russia to throw up their hands, and along with the politicians who knew they couldn't afford any more, and there was that moment there.
The Russian generals themselves said that their response to a Star Wars would be to simply pierce it. In other words, overwhelm it.
Yes.
Let's say 50% of your weapons will get past a Star Wars shield.
And that argument was made strongly here as well.
Yeah, it's very cheap. You know, you put tinfoil in your nose cone, and that tinfoil, fools the enemy's radar. You know, that was done during World War II with jet planes releasing tinfoil to fool radar. You could do that in the nuclear age. And, how cheap is tinfoil? How cheap are Mylar balloons to confuse radar? Pennies.
Yes.
Pennies to overwhelm a multi-billion-dollar radar system. And so the Russians said explicitly that you build Star Wars and we'll put more decoys in our warheads, more chaff, more tinfoil, which cost pennies, and we'll pierce the Star Wars shield. So I think what did them in was they tried to compete with the United States militarily, which was, I think, a big mistake. It bankrupted them.
Yes, it did. Anyway, it happened. At least it happened. All right, Professor, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. When we get back, we'll try and switch gears because this freight train's been really running in the bomb direction. Stuff I've never heard before. Absolutely fascinating stuff. In the nighttime, this is Coast.